stoke in their own boilers, settled ourselves down in their comfy houses and their posh town hall. No more scavenging for me. I'm a proper mayor now. His Worship Chrysler Peavey at your service.
Tom shuddered, imagining the dreadful things that must have happened here when Peavey's roughs took over. But Hester just nodded, as if she was impressed.
"Congratulations," she said. "It's a good town. Fast, I mean, well built. You're taking a risk, though. If your prey hadn't stopped when it did, you'd have plunged straight into the heart of the Rustwater and sunk like a stone."
Peavey waved the warning away.
"Oh, not Tunbridge Wheels, sweetheart. This suburb's specialized. Myers and marshes don't bother us. There are fat towns hiding in these swamps, and fatter prey still, where I'm planning to go next."
Hester nodded. "So how about letting us out then?" she asked casually. "With all this prey to catch, you could probably use a couple of good tough helpers up top."
"Ha ha!" chortled Peavey. "Nice try, Hetty, but you're out of luck. Prey's been short these last couple of years. I need all the loot and grub I can find just to keep the lads happy. And they won't be happy if I start bringing new faces aboard, especially not faces as horrible as yours."
He bellowed with laughter again, looking around at his bodyguards to make sure they were joining in. The monkey ran up onto the top of his head and squatted there, chattering.
"But you need me, Peavey,"
Hester told him, forgetting all about Tom in her desperation.
"I'm not soft. I'm probably tougher than half of your best lads. I'll fight for a place up top, if that's what it takes."
"Oh, I can use you, all right," agreed Peavey. "But not up top. It's in the engine rooms where I need help. Sorry, Hetty."
He turned away and beckoned to the woman with the horns.
"Chain 'em up, Mags, and take 'em to the slave pits."
Hester slumped down on the floor of the cage, despairing. Tom touched her shoulder, but she shrugged him irritably away. He looked past her at Peavey stalking away across his blood-stained yards, and the pirates advancing on the cage with guns and manacles. To his surprise, he felt more angry than afraid. After all that they had been through, they were going to become slaves after all. It wasn't fair. Before he knew what he was doing, he was on his feet and pounding at the greasy bars. And in a strange, thin-sounding voice, he heard himself shouting, "No!" Peavey turned around. His eyebrows climbed his craggy forehead like mountaineering caterpillars.
"No!" shouted Tom again. "You know her, and she asked you for help, and you ought to help her. You're just a coward, eating up little towns that can't escape, and murdering people, and sticking people in the slave pit because you're too scared of your own men to help them."
Mags and the other guards all raised their guns and looked at Peavey expectantly, waiting for him to give the order to blow the impertinent prisoner to pieces. But he just stood and stared, and then came walking slowly back toward the cage.
"What did you say?" he asked.
Tom took a step backward. When he tried to speak again, no words came out.
"You're from London, ain't you?" asked Peavey. "I'd recognize that accent anywhere. And you're not from the Nether Burrows, neither. What tier do you come from?"
"Two,"
stammered Tom.
"Tier two?"
Peavey looked around at his companions.
"You hear that? That's almost High London, that is. This bloke's a High London gentleman. What did you want to go slinging a gentleman like this in the lockups for, Mags?"
"But you said—" Mags protested.
"Never mind what I said," screamed Peavey. "Get him out!"
The horned woman fumbled at the lock until the door slid open, and the other pirates grabbed Tom and dragged him out of the cage. Peavey pushed them aside and started dusting him down with a sort of rough gentleness, muttering,
"That's no way to treat a gentleman. Spanner, give him back his coat.
What?
Cried the pirate, wearing Tom's coat.
No way!
Peavy pulled out a gun and shot him dead.
I said, give the gentleman back his coat!
He shouted at the startled-looking corpse, and the others hurried to pull the coat off and put it back on Tom. Peavy patted at the smouldering bullet hole on the breast.
Sorry about the blood,
he said earnestly.
These blokes, they've got no manners. Please allow me to apologize most humbly for the misunderstanding, and welcome you aboard my humble town. It's an honor to have a real gentleman aboard at last, sir. I do hope you'll join me for afternoon tea in the town hall.
Tom gaped at him. He'd only just realized that he wasn't going to be killed. Afternoon tea was the last thing he was expecting. But as the pirate mayor started to lead him away, he remembered Hester, still cowering in the cage.
I can't leave her down here, he said.
What? Hetty?
Peavy looked bewildered.
We're traveling together, explained Tom. She's my friend.
There's plenty of other girls in Tunbridge Wheels, said Peavy. Much better ones, with noses and everything. Why, my own lovely daughter would be very pleased to make your acquaintance.
I can't leave Hester behind, said Tom, as firmly as he dared.
And the mayor simply bowed and gestured to his men to open the cage again. At first, Tom thought that Peavy was interested in the same thing as Miss Fang, information about where London was headed and what had brought it out into the central hunting ground. But although the pirate mayor was full of questions about Tom's life in the city, he didn't seem to have much interest in its movements. He was just pleased to have what he called
a high London gent
aboard his town. He gave Tom and Hester a guided tour of the town hall and introduced them to his councillors, a rough-looking gang with names to match, Janny Mags and Thick Mungo and Staatsfesser Zeb, Pogo Nadgers and Zip Risky and the Traction Grad Kid. Then it was time for afternoon tea in his private quarters, a room full of looted treasures high in the town hall where his rabble of whining, snot-nosed children kept getting under everybody's feet. His eldest daughter, Cortina, brought tea in delicate porcelain cups and cucumber sandwiches on a blast-glass tray. She was a dim, terrified girl with watery blue eyes, and when her father saw that she hadn't cut the crusts off the sandwiches, he knocked her backward over the poof.
"Thomas here is from London!"
he shouted, hurling the sandwiches at her.
"He expects things posh, and you should have done 'em in little triangles!" "What can you do?"
he said plaintively, turning to Tom.
"I've tried to brung her up ladylike, but she won't learn. She's a good girl, though. I look at her sometimes and almost wish I hadn't shot her mum."
He sniffed and dabbed at his eyes with a huge skull and crossbones hanky, and Cortina came trembling back with fresh sandwiches.
"The thing is,"
Peavy explained through a mouthful of bread and cucumber.
"The thing is, Tom, I don't want to be a pirate all my life."
No,
said Tom.
No,
said Peavy.
"You see, commie boy, I didn't have the advantages what you've got when I was a kid. I didn't get no education or nothing, and I've always been ugly as sin."
"Oh, I wouldn't say that," Tom mumbled politely.
"I had to look out for myself in the dust heaps and the ditches, but I always knew one day I'd make it big. I saw London once, see, from a distance, like, off on its travels somewhere. I thought it was the most beautiful place I'd ever seen. All them tiers and the white villas up top all shining in the sun. And then I heard about them rich people what live up there, and I decided that's how I want to live, All them posh outfits and garden parties and trips to the theatre and that. So I become a scavenger, and then I got a little town of me own, and now I got a bigger one. But what I really want, he leaned close to Tom, what I really want is to be respectable.
Yes, yes, of course, agreed Tom, glancing at Hester.
You see, what I'm thinking is this, Peavy went on. If this hunting trip works out like I hope, Tunbridge Wells is going to be rich soon, really rich. I love this suburb, Tom. I want to see it grow. I want to have a proper upper level with parks and posh mansions and no oikes allowed, and elevators going up and down. I want Tunbridge Wells to turn into a city, a proper big city, with me as Lord Mayor. Something I can hand down to me sprogs. And you, Tommy, I want you to tell me how a city gent ought to be, and teach me manners, etiquette, like, so I can hobnob with other Lord Mayors and not have them laugh at me behind my back. And all my lads as well. They live like pigs at the moment. So, what do you say? Will you turn us into gentlemen?
Tom blinked at him, remembering the hard faces of Peavy's gang, and wondering what they would do if he started telling them to open doors for one another and not to chew with their mouths open. He didn't know what to say, but in the end Hester said it for him.
It was a lucky day for you when Tom came aboard, she told the mayor. He's an expert on etiquette. He's the politest person I know. He'll tell you anything you want, Peavy.
But, said Tom, and winced as she kicked his ankle.
Lovely jubbly, cackled Peavy,
spraying them both with half-eaten sandwich.
You stick with old Chrysler, Tommy boy, and you won't go far wrong. As soon as we've scoffed our big catch, you can start work. It's waiting for us on the far side of these marshes. We should reach it by the end of the week.
Tom sipped at his tea. In his mind's eye, he saw again the great map of the hunting ground, the broad sweep of the Rustwater, and beyond it...
Beyond the marshes, he said. But beyond the marshes there's nothing but the Sea of Kazakh.
Relax, Tommy boy, chuckled Chrysler Peavy. Didn't I tell you? Tunbridge Wells is specialized. Just you wait and see. Wait and... see. Get it? Wait and see.
And he slapped Tom on the back and swigged his tea, his little finger delicately raised. Chapter 18 Bevis. A few days later, London sighted prey again, a scattering of small Slavic-speaking Tractionvilles that had been trying to hide among the crags of some old limestone hills. To and fro the city went, snapping them up, while half of London crowded onto the forward observation platforms to watch and cheer. The dismal plains of the Western hunting ground were behind them now, and the discontent of yesterday was forgotten. Who cared if people were dying of heatstroke down in the nether boroughs? Good old London, good old Chrome, this was the best run of catches for years. The city chased down and ate the faster towns, and then turned back for the slower ones. It was nearly a week before the last of them was caught, a big, once proud place that was limping along with its tracks ripped off after an attack by predator suburbs. On the night it was finally eaten, there were catch parties in all the London parks, and the celebrations grew still more frantic when a cluster of lights was sighted far away to the north. A rumour started to circulate that the lights belonged to a huge but crippled city, that it was what Valentine had been sent to find, and radio signals from the 13th floor elevator would lead London north to its greatest meal ever. Fireworks banged and racketed until 2 in the morning, and Chudley Pomeroy, the acting head historian, reduced Herbert Mellifont to apprentice third class after he let off a firecracker in the museum's main hall. But at dawn, the happiness and the rumours died away. The lights in the north belonged to a huge city, all right, but it was not crippled. It was heading south at top speed, and it had a hungry look. The Guild of Navigators soon identified it as Panzerstadt Bayreuth, a conurbation formed by the coupling together of four huge Traktionsstädte. But nobody else cared very much what it was called. They just wanted to get away from it. London fired up its engines and raced on into the east until the conurbation sank below the horizon. But next morning, there it was again. Upper works glinting in the sunrise, even closer than before. Catherine Valentine had not joined in with the parties and the merrymaking, nor did she join in the panic that now gripped her city. Since her return from the deep gut, she had kept to her room, washing and washing herself to get rid of the awful slurry pit stink of Section 60. She hardly ate anything, and she made the servants fling all the clothes she had been wearing that day into the recycling bins. She stopped going to school. How could she face her friends with all their silly talk of clothes and boys, knowing what she knew? Outside, sunlight dappled the lawns, and the flowers were blooming, and the trees were all unfurling fresh green leaves. But how could she enjoy the beauty of High London ever again? All she could think of were the thousands of Londoners who were toiling and dying in misery so that a few lucky, wealthy people like herself could live in comfort. She wrote a letter to the goggle screen people about it, and another to the police, but she tore them both up. What was the point of sending them, when everyone knew that Magnus Chrome controlled the police and the goggle screens? Even the High Priest of Clio had been appointed by Chrome. She would have to wait for her father's return before anything could be done about the deep gut, providing that London hadn't gotten itself eaten by the time he came home. As for her search for the truth about the scarred girl, it had ground to a halt. Apprentice Pod had known nothing, or pretended as much, and she could think of nowhere else to turn. Then, at breakfast time, on the third day of London's flight from Panzerstadt Bayreuth, a letter came for her. She had no idea who would have written to her, and she turned the envelope over in her hands a couple of times, staring at the Tier 6 postmark, and feeling oddly afraid. When she finally tore it open, a sliver of paper dropped into her algae flakes. Ordinary London notepaper, recycled so many times that it was as soft and hairy as felt, with a watermark that said, "Waste not, want not."
"Dear Miss Valentine, please help me. There is something I must tell you. I will be at Pete's Eats in Belsize Park, Tier 5, today at 11 a.m. Signed, yours truly, a friend."
A few weeks earlier, Catherine would have been excited, but she was in no mood for mysteries any more. It was probably somebody's idea of a joke, she thought. She was in no mood for jokes either. How could she be, with London fleeing for its life and the lower tiers full of suffering and misery? She flung the note into the recycling bin and pushed her breakfast away, uneaten, then went off to wash again. But she was curious, in spite of herself. When 9 o'clock came, she said, "I will not go." At 9:30, she told Dog, "It would be pointless. There won't be anybody there." At 10, she muttered, "Pete's Eats. What sort of name is that? They probably made it up." Half an hour later, she was waiting at the central shaft terminus for a down elevator. She got off at Low Holborn and walked to the tier's edge through streets of shabby metal flats. She had put on her oldest clothes and walked fast with her head down and Dog close against her. She didn't feel proud any more when people stared. She imagined them saying, "That's Catherine Valentine, a stuck-up little miss from Tier 1. They don't know they're born, those High Londoners." Belsize Park was almost deserted, the air thick with greeny smog from London's engines. The lawns and flowerbeds had all been given over to agriculture years and years before, and the only people she could see were some labourers from parks and gardens who were moving along the rows of cabbages, spraying them with something to kill greenfly. Nearby stood a tattered conical building with a sign on its roof that read, Pete's Eats, and in smaller letters underneath, Cafe. There were metal tables under awnings on the pavement outside the door, and more tables inside. People sat talking and smoking in the thin flicker of a half-power argon globe. A boy, sitting alone at a table near the door, stood up and waved. Dog wagged his tail. It took Catherine a moment to recognize Apprentice Pod.
"I'm Bevis," he said,
smiling nervously as Catherine sat down opposite him.
"Bevis Pod."
"I remember.
I'm glad you came, miss. I've been wanting to talk to you ever since you come down to Section 60, but I didn't want the Guild to know I'd been in touch with you. They don't like us talking to outsiders. But I've got the day off 'cause they're preparing for a big meeting, so I came up here. You don't see many engineers eating in here."
"I'm not surprised," said Catherine to herself, looking at the menu. There was a big colour picture of something called a happy meal, a wedge of impossibly pink meat sandwiched between two rounds of algae bread. She ordered mint tea. It came in a glastic tumbler and tasted of chemicals.
"Are all Tier 5 restaurants like this?"
"Oh, no," said Bevis Pod. "This one's much nicer than the rest."
He could not stop staring at her hair. He had spent his whole life in the engineer warrens of the gut, and he had never seen anyone before with hair like hers, so long and shining and full of life. The engineers said hair was unnecessary, a vestige of the ground-dwelling past. But when he saw Catherine's, it made him wonder.
"You said you needed my help," Catherine prompted.
Yes,
said Bevis.
He glanced over his shoulder as if to check that nobody was watching them.
"It's about what you asked. I couldn't tell you down at the turd tanks, not with Nimmo watching. I was in enough trouble already for trying to help that poor man."
His dark eyes were full of tears again, and Catherine thought it strange that an engineer could cry so easily.
"Bevis, it's not your fault," she said. "Now, what about the girl? Did you see her?"
Bevis nodded, thinking back to the night London et Salthook.
"I saw her run past with that apprentice historian chasing after her. He shouted for help, so I ran after him. I saw the girl turn when she got to the waste chutes. There was something wrong with her face."
Catherine nodded.
"Go on." "I heard her shouting at him. I couldn't catch it all over the engines and the noise of the dismantling yards. But she said something about your father, miss. And then she pointed at herself and said something, 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 Hester Shaw. And then she jumped."
"And dragged poor Tom with her?"
"No, miss. He was left there, looking a bit stupid. Then the smoke came down and I couldn't see nothing. And next thing I knew, there were policemen everywhere, so I made myself scarce. I wasn't supposed to leave my post, you see, so I couldn't tell anyone what I'd seen."
"But you're telling me,"
said Catherine.
Yes, miss.
The apprentice blushed.
Hester Shaw.
Catherine turned the name over in her mind, but it meant nothing to her. Nor did she understand his description of events, which didn't seem to tally with Father's. Bevis must have made a mistake, she decided. He glanced around nervously again, then lowered his voice to a whisper.
"Did you mean what you said, miss, about your dad? Could he really do something to help the prisoners?"
"He will when I tell him what's happening,"
vowed Catherine.
"I'm sure he doesn't know."
"But there's no need to call me miss. I'm Catherine. Kate."
"Right,"
said Bevis solemnly.
"Kate."
He smiled again, but he still looked troubled.
"I'm loyal to the Guild," he explained. "I never wanted to be anything but an engineer, but I never expected to get assigned to the experimental prison. Keeping people in cages and making them work in the gutter and wade about in those turd tanks, that's not engineering. That's just wicked. I do what I can to help them, but I can't do much. And the supervisors just want to work them to death and then send them up to K Division in plastic bags, so even when they're dead, they won't get no rest.
What is this K Division? Asked Catherine, remembering how Nimmo had hushed the other apprentice when she mentioned it.
Is it part of the prison?
Oh, no. It's up top, in the engineerium. It's some sort of experimental department, run by Dr. Twix.
What does she use dead bodies for? Asked Catherine nervously, not at all sure that she wanted to know. Bevis Pod went a little paler.
It's just a rumour, miss, but some people in the guild say she's building stalkers. Resurrected men.
Great Cleo! Catherine thought of what she had been taught about the stalkers. She knew that her father had dug up some rusty skeletons of the engineers to study, but he had told her they were only interested in the electrical brains. Could they really be trying to make new ones?
Why? She asked. I mean, they were soldiers, weren't they? Sort of human tanks, built for some old war.
Perfect workers, miss, said Bevis, wide-eyed. They don't need feeding, or clothing, or housing. And when there's no work to be done, you can just switch them off and stack them in a warehouse, so they're much easier to store. The guild says that in the future, everybody who dies on the lower tiers will be resurrected, and we won't need living people at all, except as supervisors.
But that's horrible! Protested Catherine. London would be a city of the dead.
Bevis Pod shrugged.
Down in the deep gut, it feels like that already. I'm just telling you what I've heard. Chrome wants stalkers built, and that's what Dr. Twix does with the bodies from our section.
I'm sure if people knew about this awful plan, Catherine started to say.
Then an idea occurred to her.
Does it have a code name? Do they call it Medusa?
Blimey, how do you know about Medusa?
Bevis's face had turned paler than ever.
Nobody's supposed to know about that.
Why? Asked Catherine.
What is it, if it's not to do with these new stalkers?
It's a big guild secret, whispered Bevis. Apprentices aren't supposed to even know the name, but you hear the supervisors talking about it. Whenever something goes wrong or the city is in trouble, they talk about how everything will be all right once we awaken Medusa. Like this week, with this conurbation chasing us. Everybody's running around in a panic thinking it's the end of London, but the top guildsmen just tell each other, Medusa will sort things out. That's why they're having this big meeting at the engineerium tonight. Magnus Chrome is making an announcement about it.
Catherine shivered, thinking about the engineerium and the mysterious things that went on behind its black windows. That was where she would find the clue to her father's troubles. Medusa. It all had something to do with Medusa. She leaned closer to the boy and whispered,
Bevis, listen, are you going to this meeting? Can you tell me what Chrome says?
Oh, no, miss, Kate. No. Is strictly guildsmen only, no apprentices.
Well, couldn't you pose as a guildsman or something?
Catherine urged him.
I have a feeling that there is something bad going on, and I think this Medusa thing is at the bottom of it.
I'm sorry, miss, said Bevis, shaking his head. I wouldn't dare. I don't want to get killed and carted off to top tier and turned into a stalker.
Then help me go,
said Catherine eagerly. She reached across the table to take his hand, and he flinched at her touch and pulled back, staring at his fingers in amazement, as if it had never occurred to him that anybody would want to touch them. Catherine persisted, gently taking both his trembling hands in hers and looking deep into his eyes.
I have to find out what Chrome is really up to, she explained, for Father's sake. Please, Bevis, I have to get inside the engineerium.
Chapter 19. The Sea of Kazakh. A few hours later, as the evening mists came curling from the Rustwater marshes, Tunbridge Wheels rolled down to the edge of the sea. It paused there a while, gazing out toward a cluster of islands that rose dark and rugged from the silver water. Birds were streaming in off the sea in long skeins, and as the suburb cut its engines, the beat of their wings came echoing over the mudflats. Small waves beat steadily against the shore, and a wind from the east blew hissing through the thin grey marram grass. There was no other sound, no other movement, no light or smoke trail of a wandering town anywhere on the marshes or the sea.
"Not swervy!"
shouted Chrysler Peavy, standing with a telescope to his eye at the window of his observation bridge high in the town hall.
"Where is the lad? Pass the word for Natsworthy."
When a couple of his pirates ushered Tom and Hester in, he turned with a broad grin and held out the telescope, saying,
"Take a look, Tommy boy. I told you I'd get you here, didn't I? I told you I'd get you through these marshes safe. Now, have a look at where we're going."
Tom took the telescope and put it to his eye, blinking at the trembling, blurred circle of view until it came clear. There were dozens of little islands speckling the sea ahead, and a larger one that loomed in the east like the back of an enormous prehistoric monster breaking the water. He lowered the telescope and shuddered. "But there's nothing there," he said. It had taken more than a week for Tunbridge Wheels to pick its slow way through the quagmire, and although Chrysler Peavy had taken quite a shine to Tom, he had still not explained what he hoped to find on the far side. His men had not been told either, but they were happy enough snapping up the tiny townships that had taken shelter in the mazes of the Rustwater, semi-static places with moss-covered wheels and delicate, beautiful carvings on their wooden upperworks. They were so small that they were barely worth eating, but Tunbridge Wheels ate them anyway, and murdered or enslaved their people and fed the lovely carvings to its furnaces. It was a horrible, confusing time for Tom. He had been brought up to believe that municipal Darwinism was a noble, beautiful system, but he could see nothing noble or beautiful about Tunbridge Wheels. He was still an honored guest in the town hall, and so was Hester, although Peavy clearly didn't understand his attachment to the scarred, sullen, silent girl.
"Why don't you ask my Cortina out?"
he wheedled one night, sitting next to Tom in the old council chamber that was now his dining hall.
"Or why not one of them girls we took up the last catch? Lovely lookers they was, and not a word of English, so they can't give you any lip."
"Hester isn't my girlfriend," Tom started to say,
but he didn't want to have to go out with the mayor's daughter, and he knew Peavy would never understand the truth, that he was in love with the image of Catherine Valentine, whose face had hung in his mind like a lantern through all the miles of his adventures. So he said,
"Hester and I have been through a lot together, Mr. Peavy. I promised I'd help her catch up with London."
"But that was before," the mayor reasoned. "You're a Tunbridge Wheelsian now. You're going to stay here with me like the son I never had, and I'm just thinking that maybe the lads would accept you a bit more easily if you had a better-looking girl, you know, more ladylike."
Tom looked across the clutter of tables and saw the other pirates glaring at him, fingering their knives. He knew that they would never accept him. They hated him for being a soft city dweller and for being Peavy's favorite, and he couldn't really blame them. Later, in the little room he shared with Hester, he said,
"We have to get off this town. The pirates don't like us, and they're starting to get tired of Peavy going on at them about manners and stuff. I don't even like to think about what will happen to us if they mutiny." "Let's wait and see," muttered the girl, curled up in a far corner. "Peavy's tough, and he'll be able to keep his lads in line as long as he finds them this big catch he's been promising.
but Quirk alone knows what it is.
We'll find out tomorrow, said Tom, drifting into an uneasy sleep.
This time tomorrow, these horrible bogs will be behind us.
This time tomorrow, and the horrible bogs were behind them. As Peavy's navigator spread out his maps in the observation bridge, a strange hissing sound echoed up the stairwells of the town hall. Tom glanced up at the faces of Peavy's henchmen as they clustered around the chart table, but apart from Hester, no one seemed to have heard it. She looked nervously at him and shrugged. The navigator was a thin, bespectacled man named Mr. Ames. He had been the suburb's schoolteacher until Peavy took over. Now he was settling happily into his new life as a pirate. It was a lot more fun, and the hours were better, and Peavy's ruffians were better behaved than most of his old pupils. Smoothing his maps with his long, thin hands, he said,
"It used to be the hunting ground for hundreds of little aquatic towns, but they all ate each other. And now anti-tractionist squatters have started coming down out of the mountains and setting up home on islands like this one."
Tom craned closer. The great inland sea of Kazakh was speckled with dozens of islands, but the one Ames was pointing to was the biggest, a tattered diamond shape some 20 miles long. He couldn't imagine what was so interesting about it, and most of the other pirates looked baffled too, but Peavy was chuckling and rubbing his hands together in glee.
"Oh, the Black Island," he said. "Not much to look at, is it? But it's going to make us rich, boys, rich. After tonight, old Tunbridge Wheels will be able to set up as a proper city."
"How?"
demanded Mungo, the pirate who trusted Chrysler Peavy least and most resented Tom.
"There's nothing there, Peavy. Just a few old trees and some worthless mosses."
"What are mosses?" Tom whispered to Hester. "He means people who live in static settlements," she hissed back. "You know, like in that old saying, a rolling town gathers no moss."
"The fact is, ladies and gentlemen," announced Peavy, "that there is something on the Black Island. A few days ago, just before you come aboard, Tom, we shot down an airship that was footling about over the marshes. Its crew told me something very interesting before we killed them. It seems there's been a big battle up in Airhaven. Fires, engine damage, gas spills, the whole place knocked about so bad they couldn't stay up in the sky, but had to come down for repairs. And where'd you think they've landed?"
"The Black Island?"
suggested Tom, guessing as much from Peavy's greedy grin.
"Ha ha, that's my boy, Tommy. There's an air caravanserai there, where sky convoys refuel on their way up from the League's lands south of the mountains. That's where Air Haven's put down. They think they're safe with sea all round them and their mossy friends to help them, but they ain't safe from Tunbridge Wheels."
A ripple of excitement ran through the assembled pirates. Tom turned to Hester, but she was staring out across the sea toward the distant island. Half of him was appalled by the thought that the lovely flying town was lying crippled there, waiting to be eaten. The other half was busy wondering how on earth Peavy planned to reach it.
"To your stations, me hearties," the pirate mayor yelled. "Fire up the engines, prime the guns. By dawn tomorrow, we'll all be rich."
The pirates scrambled to obey his orders, and Tom ran to the window. It was almost dark outside now, with a last ominous glow of sunset bruising the sky above the marshes. But the streets of Tunbridge Wheels were full of light, and all around the edge of the suburb, huge orange shapes were unfolding, growing like fungus in a speeded-up film. Now, the hissing from the lower deck made sense. While Peavy talked, his town had been busily pumping air into flotation chambers, and these inflatable rubber skirts.
"Let's go swimming," shouted the pirate mayor, sitting back in his swivel chair and signalling the engine rooms.
The huge motors rumbled into life, a plume of exhaust gases drifted aft, and Tunbridge Wheels surged forward across the beach and into the sea. At first, all went well. Nothing stirred on the darkening waters as Tunbridge Wheels went chugging eastward, and up ahead the Black Island grew steadily larger. Tom opened a small side window on the bridge and stood there feeling the salt night air spill over him, feeling strangely excited. He could see pirates gathering in the old market square at the suburb's forward end, readying grappling hooks and boarding ladders. Because Airhaven would be far too large to fit into the jaws, they would have to take it by force and tear it apart at their leisure. He didn't like the idea, especially when he remembered that his aviator friends might still be on Airhaven. But it was a town-eat-town world, after all, and there was something exciting about the cutthroat recklessness of Peavy's plan. And then, suddenly, something fell out of the sky and exploded in the market square, and there was a black gash in the deck, and the men he had been watching weren't there any more. Others came running with buckets and fire extinguishers.
"Airship! Airship! Airship!" someone was shouting.
And then there were more rushing things, and buildings were exploding all over the suburb, with people flung tumbling high up into the air like mad acrobats.
"For sooty Pete's sake!" shouted Peavy, running to the shattered observation window and staring down into the smoke-filled streets.
His monkey jumped up and down on his shoulders, jabbering.
"These mossies are better organized than we gave them credit for," he said. "Searchlights, quick!"
Two wavering fingers of light rose above the town, feeling their way across the smoke-dappled sky. Where they met, Tom saw a fat, rising shape shine briefly red. The suburb's guns swung upward and fired a rippling broadside, and pulses of flame stalked the drifting clouds.
"Well, missed," hissed Peavy, squinting through his telescope. "Curse it! I should have known Airhaven would send up spotter ships. And if I'm not mistaken, it was that witch Fang's old rust bucket."
"The Jenny Hanover?" gasped Tom.
"No need to sound so pleased about it," snarled Peavy. "She's a menace. Ain't you heard of the Windflower?"
Tom hadn't told the pirate mayor of his adventures aboard Airhaven. He tried to hide his happiness at the thought that Miss Fang was still alive, and said,
"I've heard of her. She's an air trader."
"Oh, yeah," Peavy spat on the deck. "You think a trader carries that sort of firepower? She's one of the Anti-Traction League's top agents. She'll stop at nothing to hurt us poor traction towns. It was her who planted the bomb that sank Marseille, and her what strangled the poor Sultana of Palau Pinang. She's got the blood of 1,000 murdered townsfolk on her hands. Still, we'll show her, won't we, Tommy boy? I'll have her guts for goulash. I'll hang her carcass out for the buzzards. Mungo, Pogo, Mags, an extra cut of the spoils to whoever shoots down that red airship."
No one did shoot down that red airship. It was long out of range, buzzing back toward the Black Island to warn Airhaven of the approaching danger. But Tom could not have been more filled with grief and anger if he had seen it falling in flames. So that was why Miss Fang had rescued him and been so kind. All she had wanted was information for the League, and her friend, Captain Cora, had been in on it, spinning that tale about her just to win Tom's sympathy. Thank Quirk, he had not been able to tell her anything. Tunbridge Wheels was battered and burning, but the Jenny Hanover's rockets had been too small to do any serious damage. And now that the element of surprise was lost, Miss Fang did not risk another attack. The suburb chugged on into the east, pushing a thick bore of flame-lit water ahead of it. Tom could see lights on the Black Island now, Lanterns flickering along the shore, closer, between the island and the suburb, shone another cluster of lights.
Boats!
Shouted Mungo, peering through the sights of his gun. Peavy went and stood at the window, robes flapping on the rising breeze.
Fishing fleet, he grunted, sounding satisfied. First meal of the night. We'll eat 'em up by way of an aperitif. That's starters to you lot.
The fishing boats started scattering as Tunbridge Wells bore down, running goose-winged for the shelter of the shore. But one, bigger and slower than the rest, sagged away to windward.
Ho-ho, we'll have him, growled Peavy.
And Mags relayed his order into the intercom. The suburb changed course slightly, engines grumbling. The steep crags of the Black Island filled the sky ahead, blotting out the eastern stars.
What if there are guns on the heights? Thought Tom.
But if there were any, they stayed silent. He could see the white wake of the boat ahead, and beyond it, a faint, pale line of breakers on the shore. And then there were other, closer breakers, dead ahead, and Hester was shouting,
Peavy, it's a trap!
They all saw it then, but it was much too late. The fishing boat, with its shallow keel, ran clear through the reef, but the great, lumbering bulk of Tunbridge Wells struck at full speed, and the sharp rocks clawed its belly open. The suburb lurched and settled, throwing Tom off his feet and rolling him hard against the legs of the chart table. The engines failed, and in the terrible silence that followed, a klaxon began lowing like a frightened bull. Tom crawled back to the window. Down below, he saw the streets going dark as a great rush of water came bursting through the palisades. White geysers of foam sprayed up through gratings from the flooded underdeck. And mingled with the whiteness, he saw black flecks of debris and tiny, struggling figures. The boat was far away, tacking to admire her handiwork. 100 yards of sea separated the doomed suburb from the steep shores of the island. A hand grabbed his shoulder, heaving him toward the exits.
You're coming with me, Tommy boy,
snarled Chrysler Peavy, snatching a huge gun from a rack on the wall and swinging it onto his shoulder.
You two, Amesy, Mungo, Mags, you're with me.
They were with him, the pirates forming a tight protective knot around their mare as he hurried Tom down the stairs. Hester came limping behind. There were screams below, and frightened faces staring up at them from a third-floor landing already knee-deep in water.
Abandon town, hollered Peavy. Women and mares first.
They crashed into his private quarters, where his daughter stood clutching her frightened sisters. Peavy ignored her and waded to a chest in the corner, scowling with concentration as he twirled the combination lock this way and that. The chest sprang open. He dragged out a little orange bundle. And then they were on the move again, out onto the balcony where the sea was already spilling through the railings. Tom turned back into the room, meaning to help Cortina and the children, but Peavy had forgotten all about them. He flung the bundle down into the waves, and it unfolded with a complicated hiss, flowering into a small circular life raft.
Get aboard,
he snapped, taking hold of Tom and thrusting him toward it.
But...
Get aboard!
A boot in the seat of his breeches sent him tumbling over the balcony rail and down onto the yielding rubber floor of the raft. Mungo was next, then the others piled in so fast that the raft wallowed deep and water spilled over the gunwales.
Ho, ho, oh!
Wailed Cortina Peavy, somewhere away to the left, but by the time Tom had scrambled out from under Mr. Ames, the suburb was already far away. Its stern submerged, and its bows tilted high into the night sky. He looked for Hester, and found her crouching beside him. Peavy's monkey jabbered with fear, bouncing up and down on his head.
Oh, oh, oh,
came the distant cries. And there were white splashes, dozens of splashes, as people leaped from palisades and the useless tatters of the airbags. Hands clutched at the sides of the raft, and Mungo and Peavy beat them away. Frantic figures came splashing through the swell toward them, and Janny Mags stood up and fired her machine gun, churning up red water all around the raft. The suburb was tilting steeper, steeper. There was a rush of steam as the sea poured into its boilers, and then, with sudden, shocking speed, it slid under. The water boiled and heaved. For a while there were screams, faint cries for help, a brief rattle of gunfire as a drifting fragment of debris changed hands, a longer one as a few lucky pirates battled their way onto a beach. Then there was silence, and the raft turning slow circles as the current drew it in toward the shore. Chapter 20. The Black Island. At dawn, Shrike comes to the edge of the sea. The tide is turning, and the deep wheel marks that lead down into the surf are already starting to blur. Eastward, smoke rises from settlements on the shores of the Black Island. The stalker wrenches his dead face into a smile, feeling very pleased with Hester Shaw and the trail of destruction that she has left behind her. The thought of Hester is all that dragged him through the marshes. On and on it has drawn him, through mud that sucked at his damaged leg and sloughs whose bitter waters sometimes closed over his head. But at least the tracks the suburb left were easy to follow. He follows them again now, stalking down the beach and into the waves like a swimmer bent on a morning dip. Salt water slaps at the lenses of his eyes and seeps stinging through the gashes in his armor. The sounds of the gulls and the wind fade, replaced by the dim hiss of the underneath of the sea. Air or water, it makes no difference to the resurrected men. Fish goggle at him and dart away into forests of kelp. Crabs sidle out of his path, rearing up and waving their pincers at him, as if they are worshipping a crab god, armored, invincible. He ploughs on, following the water scent of oil and axle grease that will lead him to Tunbridge Wheels. A few miles from the inlet where they had come ashore, Chrysler Peavy paused at the top of a steep rise and waited for the others to catch up. They came slowly, first Tom and Hester, then Ames with his map, finally Mags and Mungo, bent under the weight of their guns. Looking back, they could see the steep, rocky flanks of the island falling to the sea, and a cluster of boats gathered above the wreck of Tunbridge Wheels, where a raft with a crane on it had already been anchored. The islanders were wasting no time in looting the drowned suburb.
"Mussy scum!" growled Peavy.
Tom had barely spoken to the mayor since they first came struggling ashore. Now he was surprised to see tears gleaming in the little man's eyes. He said,
"I'm so sorry about your family, Mr. Peavy. I tried to reach them, but..."
"Little twerps," snorted Peavy. "I wasn't sniffling over them. It's my lovely suburb. Look at it, damn mossies."
Just then, from somewhere to the south, they heard the faint clatter of gunfire. Peavy's face brightened. He turned to the others.
"Hear that? Some of the lads must have got ashore. There'll be more'n a match for them mossies. We'll link up with them. We'll capture Airhaven yet, keep a few of its people alive to repair it, kill the rest, and fly back to the mainland rich. Drop out of the sky on a few fat towns before word gets around that Airhaven's gone pirate. Catch ourselves a city, maybe."
He set off again, hauling himself up from boulder to boulder, with the monkey riding on his hunched shoulders. The others followed behind. Mags and Mungo seemed dazed by the loss of Tunbridge Wheels, and not convinced by Peavy's latest plan. They kept exchanging glances and muttering together when their mare was out of earshot. But they were in strange country, and Tom didn't think they had the nerve to move against Peavy. Not yet. As for Mr. Ames, he had never set foot on the bare earth before.
"Oh, it's horrible," he grumbled. "So difficult to walk on, all this grass. There may be wild animals or snakes. I can quite see why our ancestors decided to stop living on the ground.
Tom knew exactly how he felt. To north and south of them, the steep side of the Black Island stretched away, and above them the slope climbed almost vertically to dark crags that moaned with ghostly voices as the wind blew around them. Some of the higher pinnacles of rock had been sculpted into such wild shapes that from the beach they had looked like fortresses, and Peavy had led his party on a long detour to avoid them before he realized they were only stones.
"It's lovely," sighed Hester, limping along at Tom's side. She was smiling to herself, which he had never seen her do,
and whistling a little tune through her teeth.
"What are you so happy about?" he asked. "We're going to Airhaven, aren't we?" she replied in a whisper. "It's laired up ahead somewhere, and Peavy's little gang will never take it, not with Mosses and the Airhaven people ranged against them. They'll be killed, and we'll find a ship to take us north to London. Anna Fang's there, remember? She might help us again."
"Oh, her," said Tom angrily.
"Didn't you hear what Peavy said? She's a League spy."
"I thought so," admitted Hester.
"I mean, all those questions she kept asking us about London and Valentine."
"You should have told me," he protested. "I might have revealed an important secret."
"Why would I care?" asked Hester. "And since when have apprentice historians known any important secrets? Anyway, I thought you realized she was a spy."
"She didn't look like one."
"Well, spies don't, generally. You can't expect them to wear a big sandwich board with spy on it, or a special spying hat."
She was in a strange, jokey mood, and Tom wondered if it was because these dismal steeps reminded her of her girlhood on that other island. Suddenly she touched his arm and said,
"Poor Tom, you're learning what Valentine taught me all those years ago. You can't trust anybody."
"Huh," said Tom.
"Oh, I didn't mean you," she added hurriedly. "I think I trust you, almost. And what you did for me back in Tunbridge Wells, making Peavy let me out of the lockups like that, a lot of people wouldn't have bothered. Not for somebody like me."
Tom looked at her, and saw more clearly than ever before the kind, shy Hester peeping from behind the grim mask. He smiled at her with such warmth that she blushed, at least her strange face turned red in patches and her scar went purple. And Peavy looked back at them and hollered,
"Come on, you two lovebirds! Stop whispering sweet nothings and march!"
Afternoon. The cloud clearing eastward and sunlight dazzling down through the wavetops, flickering on the upper works of Tunbridge Wells. Shrike moves through the suburbs' streets with his head swinging slowly from side to side. Bodies drift in the flooded rooms like cold tea bags left too long in the pot. Small fish dart in and out of a pirate's mouth. A girl's hair coils on the current. Dark keels of salvage boats move overhead. He waits, hidden in the shadows, while three naked boys come diving down, flying past him with urgent motions of their arms and legs, and leaving trails of silver bubbles. They kick back to the surface, carrying guns, bottles, a leather belt. Hester is not here. Shrike turns away from the sunken suburb, following the shadows of drifting oil slicks over the silt. Wreckage is strewn along the sea floor, and floating bodies beckon him toward the roots of the Black Island. It is evening by the time he walks out of the surf, trailing flags of seaweed, water draining from inside his battered armor. He shakes his head to clear his vision, and stares around him at a beach of black sand beneath dark cliffs. It takes him most of another hour to find the life raft hidden in a tumble of house-size boulders. He unsheathes his metal claws and tears the bottom out of it, cutting off her escape. Hester is his again now. When she is dead, he will carry her gently through the drowned sunlight and the forests of kelp, back through the marshes and the long leagues of the hunting ground, to Crome. He will take her into London in his arms, like a father carrying his sleeping child. He drops on all fours in the sand and starts sniffing for her scent. Towards sundown, they finally reached the top of the slope and found themselves looking down into the center.